Chapter 5. Miller, the uglier of the two resurrected midshipmen, had been commended for his piercing eyesight and his diligence as a lookout not only by Mr. Richardson, his divisional officer, but by the captain himself. And now he could scarcely be prized from the masthead. He had an immense respect for Captain Aubrey. Jack's natural authority, his reputation as a fighting captain, and his power of lifting up or casting down played their part, of course, but it was his cracking on that raised Miller's respect to an enthusiastic veneration. In his 5 years at sea, he'd never seen anything like it. And his shipmates, some of whom had been afloat 10 times as long, assured him he never would. And to be sure, Jack Aubrey, with a very sound, new-masted, new-rigged, clean-bottomed boat, drove the Nutmeg extremely hard now that he was in the deep waters of the Celebes Sea. He had good officers, a fairly good set of hands. They were not surprises yet, but they were already far better than the common run, and a strong sense of frustration and guilt about his wrong decision. Day after day the Nutmeg ran eastwards under towering pyramids of canvas, Jack rooted to the quarterdeck and Miller to the masthead. He longed beyond anything to delight and astonish Captain Aubrey with the first report of the Cornelis topgallantsails just nicking the horizon. Day after day the degrees of longitude went by, with Jack and the master checking and double-checking them by chronometer and by lunar observation, and with Miller spending his watches below, high above them. Sometimes he took his meals up there in a handkerchief, and always the telescope Reed had given him, saying, "It's no use to a one-armed cove, you know, but you shall treat Harper and me to a bowl of punch when we reach Botany Bay." Many a proa did he see, particularly west of 123 degrees east, and the occasional junk coming down from the Philippines. Those he reported in a non-committal howl, often angering the official lookouts, and rarely earning much thanks from the quarterdeck. For the last few days, however, he'd been mute. Not only were there no vessels to be seen, but there was no horizon either. A soft, warm haze filled the air, making it difficult to breathe and impossible to distinguish sea from sky. There was no edge to the world. And only a providential clearing of the mist to the nor-nor-west allowed him to discern a ship some 2 miles away. A ship steering southeast under topsails, no more. In a confident roar, he hailed the quarterdeck. "On deck there! A ship, hull up on the larboard quarter, steering southeast!" A moment later, transmitted by one taut set of rigging after another, he felt the vibration of a heavy, powerful body racing aloft, and then he heard the captain's voice from the main top telling him to clear the way. They passed in the shrouds on either side of the topmast, and Jack said, "Where away, Mr. Miller?" "Perhaps half a point on the quarter, sir, but she comes and goes." Jack settled himself on the cross trees, staring over the soft blue sea to the nor-nor-west. Hope, which had almost given way to resignation, flared up again, making his heart beat so that he felt its pounding in his throat. The haze cleared once more, showing the sail quite close, and hope fell to a reasonable pitch. Of course, a ship steering southeast couldn't have been the Cornelie. Nevertheless, he gave the order that ran up the colours and brought the Nutmeg round in an elegant curve to close the stranger, a quite remarkably shabby Dutch merchantman, fat and deep-waisted. She made no attempt to escape, but lay there with a back topsail until the Nutmeg ranged up on her windward side. Her crew, mostly black or greyish-brown, lined the rail looking pleased. Not one of her little range of guns, 6-pounders in all likelihood, had been run out. "What ship is that?" hailed Jack. "Alkmaar, sir. From Manila to Manado. Let the master come across with his papers." The boat splashed down, the master came across. His papers included a license to trade from Raffles Secretariat in Batavia, and they were perfectly in order. Jack handed them back and offered the Dutchman a glass of Madeira. "To tell you the truth, sir," said he, "I'd much rather have a keg of water, however old." and in answer to Jack's questioning eye, he went on, "Two or three barrels would be more welcome still if you can spare them. We've been down to half pipkins these last days, but even so I doubt we can fetch Menado without a recruit. The hands are mortal dry, sir." "I think we can manage that, Captain," said Jack, "but drink up your wine and tell me first how you come to speak English so well, and then how you come to be so short of water." "Well, as for the English, sir, I was in and out of herring basses, Dutch or English, no matter which, when I was a little chap and a young man, in and out of Yarmouth all the time. And it was there I was pressed and sent aboard the Billy Ruffin, Captain Hammond, for close on 2 years until the peace. And as for the water, we started the top two tiers over the side, running from a couple of pirate junks off the Cagayanes. But when we were free of them, I found that some fool had started almost all the ground tier, too, dead against my orders. Oh, it's been a damned unfortunate voyage, sir. Next thing, a French frigate in these here waters, would you believe it, brought us to. How many guns? 32, sir. Far too many for me to argue with. She was short of water likewise, but when I showed them we had barely enough to get home with, if that, whereas she had a good watering place under her lee, since she was bound for the passage and beyond, she let it alone. I must say they behaved quite pretty, considering. No pillaging, and left our cargo be, nothing wanton. And though they did take all our powder and all our sails, bar what you see, sir, the officer spoke civil and gave us a draft on Paris that may be honoured some day, I hope. How much powder? 4 barrels, sir. Halves, I suppose. No, sir, whole barrels. And best Manila large-grain cylinder powder at that. Where's the watering place? The island called Nil Desperandum, sir. Not the one down in the Banda Sea, but the northern one. It's a slow business watering there because of the winding passage and the smallness of the stream. No basin. But it is the best water in these parts, and I should have gone along with them, only I could never have beat back again against the monsoon. My ship ain't the Goliath. What do you call her now, sir? Nutmeg, said Jack. And after a little more conversation about the French frigate, the Cornélie, of course, her crew and her qualities, and about the watering place at Nil Desperandum, he stood up, saying, "Forgive me, Captain, but I'm pressed for time. I shall have to send the water over by the fire engine. I shall come alongside as close as I can and pass a line for the hose. You'd better get back to your ship at once and lay everything along." The ships parted after perhaps the most unpleasant quarter of an hour in Fielding's life as a first lieutenant. There was a considerable swell. The fire engine's hose was criminally short. The Alkmaars were criminally negligent in booming off, and the Nutmegs weren't much better. They had no respect for his paintwork. And if he'd heard Captain Aubrey call out that there wasn't a moment to be lost once, he'd heard him a score of times. And even after the lane of water between the ships had widened to a quarter of a mile and the Dutchman's grateful hooting was faint on the breeze, his spirits were so ruffled that he kicked a ship's boy for pulling off loose ribbons of paint on the blackstrake. Immediately afterwards he was summoned to the cabin, and he hobbled aft with an uneasy heart, straightening his clothes as he went. He knew very well that Captain Aubrey disliked starting with a rope's end or a cane, kicking, cobbing, and even reproachful words such as "lubber" or "damn your infernal limbs," unless they were uttered by himself. And the First Lieutenant didn't relish the prospect of reproof. When he opened the door, however, he found the captain leaning over a chart with the doctor on one side and Mr. Warren on the other. "Mr. Fielding," said Jack, looking up with a smile, "do you know what Nil Desperandum means?"
"No, sir," said Fielding.
"It means never say die, or luck may turn yet," said Jack, "and it's the name of an island about 300 miles to leeward just before the passage."
"Indeed, sir. I'd imagined it was somewhere east of Timor."
No, that's another one. It's the same with Desolation. There are plenty of Desolation Islands, and there are plenty of Nil Desperandums, too. With any luck, we shall find the Cornélie waltering there. My aim is to run in and get as close as possible to her. And for that, we must look as much like a merchantman as ever we can. How I wish I'd thought to exchange the Alkmaar's thin, patched, shabby sails for a suit of ours. But zeal will do wonders.
Yes, sir, said Fielding. Never mind your paintwork, Mr. Fielding, said Jack. Never mind your prettily black yards, square by lifts and braces. Take your pattern from the Alkmaar and be damned to cleanliness.
Yes, sir, said Fielding, who minded very much indeed about his paintwork,
and who had turned the nutmeg out with exceptional care, the trimmest 20-gun ship in the service, fit for any admiral's inspection.
Ha! Said Maturin suddenly. I remember what a vile mudscow we made of the dear surprise to deceive the Spartan. Turds everywhere.
Oh, sir! Cried the master in protest. Mind you, Mr. Fielding, said Jack, the filth doesn't have to be fundamental. It doesn't have to bear very close scrutiny. We only have to look so like a merchantman that we can come within range. For once we start firing, we must, of course, do so under our own colours.
Stephen left them discussing the details of this horrid change and went to make his rounds. Macmillan greeted him with an anxious face and said, I'm very sorry to tell you, sir, that two dental cases have reported, and I must confess that I'm at a loss, wholly at a loss. Macmillan uttered these words in Latin, as well he might, the patients being just at hand, their anguished eyes fixed upon the surgeon's. In any case, the Latin comforted them, being the tongue of the learned, not of some cowleech who'd taken the bounty and who topped it the physician on the forecastle.
So am I, said Stephen, having examined the teeth awkwardly placed, deeply carious molars in both cases.
So indeed am I. However, we must do our best. Let me see what instruments we possess. Looking them over, he shook his head and said, Well, at least let us apply oil of cloves and then stuff the hollows with lead in the hope they'll not crumble under our forceps.
A vain hope. And when at last he left the seamen to the care of their messmates and the ship's butcher who'd held their heads, he was paler than they.
It is an odd thing, he said, returning to the cabin where Jack was settled on the rudder casing, plucking the strings of his fiddle and watching the broad wake tear away. It's an odd thing. Yet although I can take off a shattered limb, open a man's skull, cut him with a stone, or if he's a woman, deliver him of an uneasy breech presentation in a seaman-like manner and without a qualm, not indeed with indifference to the suffering and the danger, but with what may perhaps be called a professional constancy of mind, I cannot extract a tooth without real agitation. It's the same with Macmillan, though he's an excellent young man in every other respect. I shall never go to sea again without an experienced tooth-drawer, however illiterate he may be.
I'm sorry you had such a disagreeable time, said Jack. Let's both take a cup of coffee.
Coffee was as much his universal remedy as the alcoholic tincture of opium had once been for Stephen, and he now called for it loud and clear. Killick looked sourer than usual. Coffee was not customary at this time of day.
It'd have to be black, then, he said. I can't go on milking Nanny watch and watch, doing she'll go dry. A goat ain't a cistern, sir.
Strong black coffee, said Stephen some minutes later. How well it goes down! And how glad I am that I didn't indulge myself in my coca leaves on finishing with the sick berth, as I'd intended. They calm the mind, sure, but they do away with one's sense of taste. I shall chew three when the pot is out, however. These leaves, which he'd first encountered in South America, were his present, purely personal, Catholicon. And although he travelled with enough packed in soft leather bags to last him twice round the world, he was remarkably abstemious. These three leaves, now to be chewed so late in the afternoon, were an unusual treat. Surely, he said, gazing about, the ship is going at a most uncommon speed. See how the water flings wide, see how the turbulence sweeps away into the past. And there is a general sound all about us. You are to observe that we both raise our voices, that cannot be located, but whose predominant note is almost exactly that G your thumb is plucking.
Hardly were these words out than Reed came bouncing in. His wound had healed wonderfully, but Stephen still made him wear a kind of padded bandolier to protect the socket in case of falls and lurches, and his empty sleeve was pinned to it. He was treated with extraordinary tenderness by all hands. He'd entirely recovered his spirits, and he had already developed an agility that almost compensated for his loss. "Mr. Richardson's duty, sir," he said, "and he thought you'd like to know that we're doing 12 knots in one fathom almost exactly. I chalked it up myself." Jack laughed aloud. 12 knots, one fathom, and that with the wind so far abaft. Thank you, Mr. Reed. Pray tell Mr. Richardson that he may set a skyscraper on the foremast if he sees fit, and that there will be no quarters this evening. Aye, aye, sir. And if you please, he said, that was I to see the doctor, I should tell him there's a prodigious curious bird keeping company, very like an albatross, with somewhat in its beak. Stephen ran up on deck in time to watch the bird's long struggle to disengage the cuttlefish bone it had transfixed. Once the bone was free, the albatross wheeled away, racing southward across the wind and vanishing almost at once among the white horses. "I thank you heartily for showing me the bird," he said to Richardson, who replied, "Not at all, sir." And then, taking him by the elbow, "If you'll stand just here and bend a little, looking at the top of the foremast, I'll show you a skyscraper in a minute. We set them flying, you know." Stephen bent and gazed, and amidst a series of orders, pipes, and the cry of "Belay," he saw a triangular scrap of white appear high above all the other whitenesses, clear in the sun, to the evident satisfaction of the many hands along the immaculate deck. It had just been swept for the second time since dinner. "One of the smaller albatrosses," he said, coming back, and it was in the act of detaching a cuttle bone from its upper mandible. "The bird may have carried it for 1,000 miles and more." "I wish it had been a letter from home," said Jack. They were both silent for a moment, and then Jack went on. "I'd always connected albatrosses with the high southern latitudes. What kind was this one?" "I cannot tell. I only know that it was not Linnaeus exulans, though he has it wandering in the tropics. There is one species from Japan that has been described, and another from the Sandwich Islands. This may have been either, or some quite unknown bird. But I should have had to shoot it to make sure, and I've grown rather tired of killing. You've noticed, I make no doubt, that the horizon is now quite clear." "Yes. The haze vanished in the night, and we had an excellent observation of Russell Haig and the moon, which confirmed not only our position by chronometer, but even by our dead reckoning, almost to the very minute of longitude, which was tolerably gratifying, I believe." Then, seeing that this splendid news aroused no particular emotion, or indeed anything but a civil inclination of the head, he said, "What do you say to taking up our game where we left off? I was winning, you'll recall." "Winning, for our love! How your ageing memory does betray you, my poor friend," said Stephen, fetching his cello. They tuned, and at no great distance Killick said to his mate, "There they are at it again. Squeak, squeak, boom, boom. And when they do start playing, it's no better. You can't tell t'other from one. Never nothing a man could sing to, even as drunk as Davy's sow." "I remember them in the Lively, but it's not as chronic as a wardroom full of gents with German flutes belly aching night and day, like we had in Thunderer. No, live and let live, I say. Fuck you, William Grimshaw." The game they played was that one should improvise in the manner of some eminent composer, or, as nearly as indifferent skill and a want of inspiration allowed, that the other, having detected the composer, should then join in accompanying him with a suitable continuo until some given point understood by both, when the second should take over, either with the same composer or with another. They, at least, took great pleasure in this exercise, and now they played on into the darkness with only a pause at the end of the first dog watch, when Jack went on deck to take his readings of temperature and salinity with Adams and to reduce sail for the night.
They were still playing when the watch was set. And Killick, laying the table in the dining room, said, "This will stop their gob for a while, thank God. Keep your great greasy thumbs off of the plates, Bill, do. Put your white gloves on. Snuff the candles close, and don't get any wax or soot on a goddamn snuff. No, 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 give it here." Killick loved to see his silver set out, gleaming and splendid, but he hated seeing it used, except insofar as use allowed him to polish it again. Moderate, very moderate use. He opened the door into the moonlit, music-filled great cabin and stood there severely until the very first pause, when he said, "Supper's on table, sir, if you please." It was a good supper, consisting, through Mrs. Raffles' kindness, of spaghetti, mutton chops and toasted cheese, followed again through Mrs. Raffles' kindness by plum cake. During the meal they drank their usual toasts, and with the last of the wine Jack said, "To the dear surprise, and may we meet her soon." "With all my heart," said Stephen, and drained his glass. They sat reflecting in silence while the current sang past the hull, and after some minutes Jack said, "I wonder whether you wouldn't be well advised to sleep below for this bout. I'm going to take the middle watch, and I shall be in and out at all hours. I mean to let her run all night and to start disguising her tomorrow. And at first light we shall gut the cabin and trundle the chasers aft." In most of Jack Aubrey's commands, Stephen, as the ship's surgeon, had an alternative cabin opening off the gunroom. He lay there now, gently swaying with the nutmeg's pitch and roll as she ran through the darkness. He lay there on his back with his hands behind his head, perfectly at his ease. He didn't sleep. The coffee, and even more the coca leaves, quite outweighed the port, but he didn't care. His mind ran along, as smooth and easy as the nutmeg, one ear hearing the general deep voice of a taut-rigged ship with a fine spread of canvas abroad, the unchanging naval sounds, the faint bells in due succession, the cry of "All's well" right round the ship, the muffled trampling of bare feet at the changing of the watch. It ran with no particular guidance, drifting agreeably from one set of ideas to another, connected by some tenuous association, until they came to the possibility, however remote, of finding the surprise at the far end of the Salibabu passage. As he evoked her name, so he had a clear-cut mental image of her. He smiled in the darkness. And then quite suddenly the loss of his fortune came back to him. His present relative poverty. The surprise might belong to him, but there would be none of those splendid cruises he'd promised himself when peace came back again. Cruises in which no imperious voice should ever say, "There's not a moment to be lost," and in which he and Martin could wander at large on unknown shores and on remote islands never seen by any man, still less any naturalist, where birds could be taken up by hand, examined, and put back on their nests. Relative poverty. He wouldn't be able to cruise. He wouldn't be able to endow his chairs of comparative osteology. They would have to sell the house in Half Moon Street. But although he'd committed himself to a certain number of annuities, his calculations, such as they were, seemed to show that a modest competence might remain if he continued in the service. And perhaps they might be able to keep Diana's new place in Hampshire for her Arabian horses. In any event, he was perfectly certain that she would take it well, even if they had to retire to his half-ruined castle in the mountains of Catalonia. His only fear was that on hearing the news she would sell her famous great diamond, the Blue Peter, the joy of her life. For not only would doing so take away that joy, but it would also give her an immense moral advantage. And Stephen was convinced that moral advantage was a great enemy to marriage. Few happy marriages did he know among his friends and acquaintance, and in those few the balance seemed to him equal. Then again he found it more blessed to give than to receive.
He had a strong disinclination to being obliged, and sometimes, when he was low-spirited, he put this down to an odious incapacity for gratitude. Moral advantage. After his parents' death, he'd spent much of his childhood and youth in Spain, housed by various members of his mother's family, before finding a true home with his godfather and cousin, Don Ramon. Two of these relations, Cosi Francesc and Cosi Eulalia, he knew well at three distinct periods of his life as a small child, as an adolescent, and as a grown man. At the time of his first visit, they were a newly married pair, and they seemed quite fond of one another, though they were already tolerably strict and severe. Early morning mass every day in the icy cathedral of Teruel. During his next stay, the fondness was by no means apparent in anything but forms of unselfishness and deference to the other's will. And at his third, it was quite clear to him that what fondness there may have been had been eaten away by a struggle for moral superiority. Their life had become a competitive martyrdom. Competitive fasting, competitive holiness, competitive fortitude and self-denial, a dreadful, uncomplaining cheerfulness in that ancient, cold, damp, stony house, an intensely watchful competition that could only be won by the cousin that died first. Though Cosi Eulalia had told him as a secret never to be divulged that she had spent all Don Ramon's presents and all her dress allowance for the last 3 years in prayers and masses for her husband's spiritual welfare. It was not that he thought Diana would profit from her advantage in any way, or even be aware that she had one. That wasn't her style at all. It was rather that he, with his fundamentally rather inferior character, should be oppressed by her generosity. Six bells, quite distinctly. What watch were they in now, for the love of God? And surely the ship was moving faster still. The fundamental note had risen half a tone. What more tiresome life than a sailor's, perpetually obliged to leap out of bed and run about in the noxious damps. His mind turned to his probable, almost certain daughter, now little more than a larva, with virtually no conversation, but with such potentialities. A Mozart string quartet began singing in his head. "If you please, sir," said a voice that had been going on for some time and that he connected with the irregular motion of his cot. "If you please, sir." "Were you jerking the strings or lifts of my cot, Mr. Conway?" asked Stephen, giving him a malevolent look. "Yes, sir." "Beg pardon, sir," said Conway. "Captain's compliments, and it's all over now. Hopes you've not been too much disturbed, and that you will join him at breakfast." "My compliments to the captain, if you please, and I should be happy to wait on him." "There you are, Stephen," cried Captain Aubrey. "Good morning to you. I thought you'd be amazed." Amazed he was, and for once it showed in his face. For although the forward bulkhead had been replaced so that he walked into the dining cabin through the usual door past the marine sentry, the rest of the space aft was bare. No wall dividing the dining cabin from the great cabin. A great bare space with nothing in it but the two chairs, the breakfast table, and far away the 9-pounder chase guns hard up against the ordinarily imperceptible stern port lids. The checkered canvas deck covering was gone. The room was strangely vast and empty. Not a chest, not a bookcase, not an elbow chair. Nothing but these guns on the bald planking with their shot garlands, wads, rammers, worms and the rest. There was almost nothing familiar in the cabin but the table, the far-off stern windows, the carronades on either side, and the delightful smell of coffee and frying bacon brought aft by who knows what complex eddies and countercurrents. Jack rang the bell, observing, "I've not invited any officers or mids. They're all too filthy." And in any case, it's far too late in the day. You'll be even more amazed when you go on deck. We started ruining the poor nutmeg's looks when we ordinarily clean the decks. And I do assure you the forecastle is already a hissing and an abomination. Breakfast came in. Breakfast on the heroic scale, calculated for a large, heavy, powerful man who'd been up before first light, and who had so far eaten no more than a piece of biscuit. The clash of knives and forks, of china upon china, the sound of pouring coffee, a conversation reduced to such words as, "Will I pass you another egg, sir?"
"That cannot have been four bells," said Stephen, looking up from his plate with an attentive ear.
"I believe it was, though," said Jack, who had now reached marmalade and his second pot of coffee.
"'Twas benevolent in you to wait, brother," said Stephen. "I take it kindly."
"I hope you got some sleep, at all events," said Jack.
"Sleep? But why should I not sleep at all?"
"As soon as the idlers were called, we made enough din to raise the dead, getting the chasers aft and opening the port lids. I doubt they'd been opened when she was weighed from the bottom of the sea, they were so cruelly tight. Painted in, too, of course, right across the upper counter for pretty, so they could not be seen. I thought it would have broken Fielding's heart as we beat and thumped them into some sense of their duty. But he looked a little less wretched when we had the guns in place. The breaching and the tackles hide some of the scars, and so you slept through it all. Well, well."
Stephen frowned and said, "I cannot conceive what you hope to gain by placing them there and ruining our parlour, our music room, our one solace on the ocean's bosom. But then I'm no great sailor."
"Oh, I should never say that. Oh, not at all, not really," said Jack. "But if you like, I'll explain them by telling you about my plan of attack, if anything that depends upon one probable surmise but countless unknowns can be called a plan. I should be very happy to hear it. As you know, we hope to catch the Cornelie watering at Nil Desperandum in the cove on the southern side. Not unreasonable hope, since watering there's a very slow business and she needs a great deal for the next leg of her voyage. In the best of cases, I should run in, looking like a Dutch merchantman in need of water too, and, of course, wearing Dutch colours. I should run in under shabby topsails, and, with luck, I should come close alongside, whip up the ensign, give her a broadside and board her in the smoke. It shouldn't be a very difficult boarding. If she had even a small party ashore, our numbers would be about equal, and then there's the immense advantage of surprise. But that is the best of cases, and I must provide for others. Suppose, for example, she lies awkwardly, or suppose I miss the channel. In short, suppose I cannot run close alongside, then I must turn about, since I cannot engage her broadside to broadside at any distance, not with carronades against her long 18-pounders. Turn and entice her out, for I have no fear of her not chasing. I know she's short of stores, in fact she's probably very, very short. Her being out of water so soon makes it seem likely that she left Pulo Prabang in a great hurry. Nothing could be more probable than a quarrel in those circumstances. The Frenchman had lost all credit. So, you see, I'm sure of her chasing us. And I'm sure of being able to outsail her, both by and large. The Dutchman assured me she couldn't come within 7 points close hauled, and she's wretchedly equipped for a breeze abaft the beam. She was so short of sailcloth that they took mere rags from the Alkmaar as better than what they had. My plan is to make her think we're trying to escape, the usual lame duck tactics, and so lead her through the Salibabu Passage by night, disappear behind the second island at the far end, sending a well-lit boat ahead, and come out as she passes by. Once she's passed, we have the weather gauge. And it'd be strange if we didn't lay her alongside in a matter of a glass or two. Would she indeed chase all night in these dangerous parts? Oh, I think so. Celebaba was a deep water passage, much better known than the South China Sea. And in any case, her captain is a bold, enterprising man. He heaved his ship down at Pulo Prabang, which I should scarcely have dared to do. And, as I say, he's desperately short of stores. He has an enormous tract of ocean to sail across, and would risk anything to seize a well-found ship, man-of-war or not. Furthermore, his course lies through the passage. It doesn't take him an inch out of his way. I'm so sure of his attempting this that I've shifted the chasers aft, as you see. He'll certainly pepper us as we run, and I should like to be able to reply. You'll say that a 9-pounder, looking affectionately at Beelzebub, his own brass chaser, will not carry away a frigate's foreyard or even foretopsail yard at the distance I intend to keep, which is profoundly true. But there is always the lucky shot that severs a lift or a backstay, causing sad confusion. I remember when I was a boy in the West Indies, a 6-pounder fired from the forecastle that cut the chase's peak halyards. A valuable schooner that was going from us like smoke and oakum. Down came our mainmast, and of course we snapped her up. To be sure, that works both ways, and the French are sometimes devilish clever at pointing their guns. On the perhaps rather wild supposition that the Cornélie is limited to the 4 barrels she took from the Alkmaar, how long would the peppering last? He regretted his question as soon as he'd asked it. And indeed, Jack answered rather coldly, 4 barrels would allow 120 shots from a 9-pound chaser, or 4 18-pounder broadsides if the bow gun were left out, which it often is. But at this point, a somewhat haggard Fielding came in to report progress. How are the hands taking it? Asked Jack. There was a certain amount of reluctance here and there, as you noticed yourself, sir, said Fielding. But now they all seem won over to the idea, and some of the younger topmen have to be restrained rather than encouraged. A proper rag fair she looks forward. Irish pennants slush over the side. The head's enough to make a madhouse blush. I'll come as soon as the doctor's finished his cap, said Jack. I promised him he should be amazed. I'm with you now, said Stephen, starting up. Pray lead on. There, said Jack, as they all three stood at the quarterdeck barricade facing forward. There were several other officers on the leeward side, and they too watched Stephen's face attentively. Where am I to look? He asked. Why, everywhere, cried both Jack and Fielding. It seems much the same to me, said Stephen. Oh, for shame, cried Jack, amidst a general sound of disapproval. Do you not see the loathsome deck? The rope yarns hanging about in the rigging? Asked Fielding. The loose reef points? Asked the master, moved beyond discretion. The fag ends of rope everywhere? There is a blue patch on this near topsail that may not have been there yesterday, said Stephen, anxious to please, and perhaps the sail itself is less bright than usual. This had no success, however. Pursed lips, shaken heads, mutual looks of intelligence. While behind him an involuntary growl burst from the quartermaster at the con. Perhaps I'd better occupy myself with what I am more competent to judge, he said. I shall take my morning rounds. Do you choose to accompany me, sir? Jack ordinarily visited the sick berth with the surgeon to ask the invalids how they did, an attention that was much appreciated, but this morning he excused himself, adding, You were no doubt misled by our not having shifted the other sails, but it'll be clearer after dinner. Even before dinner, the change was somewhat more evident. Stephen came on deck in time to see the taking of the sun's altitude as it crossed the meridian. He'd been present at this ceremony times without number, but he had rarely seen it carried out so earnestly.
Every sextant and quadrant the Nutmeg possessed was in action, and all the midshipmen stood elbow to elbow along her starboard gangway. And never was the ship in such a condition. The tide of squalor had flowed aft, almost reaching the holy quarterdeck, and even the most unobservant eye couldn't fail to notice the grimy, patched topsails, the most striking contrast to the brilliant, sunlit white of the courses, t'gallants and royals and their own spotless stunsails, the carefully dulled brass, the uneven ratlins, the dirty buckets hung here and there in defiance of all decency, the general air of advanced seediness. Many of the hands had spent their time on line-of-battle ships, which called for sweepers almost every glass, and which never, never resorted to practices of this kind. And at first they looked upon the deliberate profanation with horror. But gradually they'd been won over, and now, with the enthusiasm of converts, they daubed her sides with filth almost to excess. The ceremony came to its invariable end with the first lieutenant stepping across the deck, taking off the hat that he'd put on for the purpose, reporting noon to Captain Aubrey, and receiving the reply, "Make it so, Mr. Fielding," which gave the new naval day its legal existence. And immediately after this, as eight bells were struck and the hands were piped to dinner with the usual roaring and trampling, he noticed Jack and the master exchange a nod of satisfaction, from which he concluded without much difficulty that the Nutmeg, racing along in this spirited way, her bow-way flung white and wide, was doing so on the right parallel. Their own dinner, which again they took by themselves in the austere, echoing great cabin, was barely edible, Wilson having lost his head in the excitement. But apart from observing, "Well, at least the wine goes down well, and I believe there's rice pudding to come," Jack took little notice. After a glass or two, he said, "You do understand, Stephen, do you not, that all this is merely provisional, just in the event that the Cornelia has done exactly what I want her to have done?" Stephen smiled and nodded, reflecting, "And I do understand how the evil eye can be attempted to be averted." Jack went on, "This morning I didn't tell you about my sequence of events, though it is of the very first importance. To begin with, I must raise the island at first light to make sure whether the Cornelia is there or not. It'd be absurd to carry out some of the more extravagant capers I have in mind until that's decided. I'm reasonably confident that we can do so, and with most of the night to spare. The master and I and Dick Richardson all agree very closely in our reckoning, and we should have a very good lunar observation tonight with this clear sky. If it tells us that we are where I think we are, I shall reduce sail and draw in gently until dawn, when I hope Nil Desperandum will be in sight away to leeward." "Aha!" said Stephen, fired for once with a kind of martial fervour. "I shall desire Welby to give me a call at 4 bells, would it be? He sleeps next door. Sleeps, that's to say, when he's not trying to learn French, poor soul." "I shall send the mate of the watch," said Jack. "Then suppose she's there. We strike to gallant masts, down on deck, dip below the horizon, carry out my other capers, and stand in under topsails quite leisurely, you understand? Because if circumstances are not right, and everything depends on circumstances, or if my direct attack fails, I must entice her out a little after noon, so that we may run through the passage in the night. And after moonset, I can draw ahead, put the helm hard over, nip behind my island, showing neither a glim nor a scrap of canvas, and lying to a drift anchor till she passes, chasing the lights of the boat we've sent on. And once she is to leeward, why, there we are. We have the weather gauge." "Ah, very good. Will I pour you some wine?" "If you please. Capital.
port. Rarely drunk better. Stephen, you're aware of the importance of the weather gauge, are you not? I don't have to explain that a better sailor who has the weather gauge can force an action as and when she chooses. The Nutmeg cannot play at long bowls with the Cornélie, cannot keep up a broadside battle at long range. But coming up fast in her wake, she can range alongside, hammer her and board her. Though, of course, I don't have to tell you that. It would be strange if the weather gauge had to be explained to so old a sea dog. Though I must confess that there was a time when I confused it with that thing which creaks on the roof showing which way the wind is blowing. Yet could you not obtain this valuable gauge by some less arduous means than running 100 miles and hiding behind a more or less mythical island which no one has ever seen? And that in the dark, a perilous proceeding if ever there was one? Why, no! I cannot work to windward of him without exposing myself to his broadside at a distance which our ship cannot stand. And if I decide to reduce sail to let him come up, he'll very naturally decline, put his helm down and batter me from beyond the effective range of carronades. For I cannot go on the assumption that the Cornélie has no more powder than the Alkmaar's 4 barrels. And as for the island, it's not mythical at all. There are 2 of them. Rising steep to from 50 fathom and well surveyed. The Dutch used the passage a great deal, and Raffles gave me an excellent chart. But even so, let's hope that the first plan of running in and boarding us straight away comes to root. But that's to say, he paused, frowning. Rules the roost? No. Takes fruit? Oh, be damned to it. The trouble with you, Stephen, if you don't mind my saying so, is that although you're the best linguist I was ever shipmates with, like the Pope of Rome that spoke 100 languages, Pentecost come again, would it be Malibeke you have in mind? I dare say, a foreigner in any case. And I am sure you speak quite as many, and like a native or better, but English isn't one of them. You don't get figures quite right, and now you've put the word clean out of my head. The old sea dog appeared on deck next day at dawn, looking as some other old dogs do when they're roused untimely from their pad, uncombed, unbrushed, matted. He was not exceptional. Nearly all the officers were in their oldest working clothes, and some had been up much longer. Yet, even if Dr. Maturin had been tarred and feathered, he would have excited no remark. All eyes were fixed on the lookout at the Jack Cross trees, and the lookout's eyes were fixed on an island sharp on that pure horizon to the east nor'east. The sun was up, quite clear of the sea, an incandescent ball already, and its rays lit almost all the island's upper part. Those on deck could see no more. Only the telescope high above could make out that distant shore. The breeze was now right aft. It had diminished, and there was little sound from the rigging. They stood there in silence, the whole ship's company, as the sunlight travelled down the southwest side of Nil Desperandum. Warren, the master, uttered a thundering fart. No one smiled, frowned, or took his eyes from the masthead. At long, regular intervals, the ship passed through the peaks of the southwest swell, her cutwater making a sound like shh. The cry came down, shaky with emotion. On deck there! A pause for 2 waves. She's there, sir! I mean, I see a ship. Yards across, lying perhaps 1/2 mile offshore, topsails loose to dry. Hard over, said Jack to the man at the wheel, and raising his voice, very good, Mr. Miller. Jump down on deck now, Mr. Fielding. We'll strike t'gallant mast directly, if you please. With the t'gallant masts on the booms and the Nutmeg safely out of sight of the land, Jack said, when we've furled everything but topsails and forestaysail, we may proceed with our painted strips, but furled in the loose bunt, swagging horribly with gaskets all ahoo. Do you hear me there, Mr. Seymour? Directing his voice nominally to Seymour on the forecastle, but, in fact, to the ship's company,
who had hitherto been encouraged to furl with exact precision, as taut and trim as in a royal yacht, and who now gazed at one another with wondering grins. For in spite of all that had gone before, this was a degree of impropriety that even the boldest minds hadn't conceived. The strips of which Captain Aubrey had spoken were lengths of sailcloth with gun ports painted on them. Strips of the kind that many merchantmen, with few or no actual cannon, wore along their sides in the hope of deterring pirates. They took up a great deal of space on deck while they were being prepared, as Stephen knew very well, having seen Jack use them before. But this time, with a crew not used to Captain Aubrey's ways, they took even more, and he retreated farther and farther. On reaching the taffrail, he decided that he was really too much in the way and that he should retire, in spite of the extraordinary beauty of the sea and sky and the champagne quality of the air, uncommon between the tropics and almost unknown to Dr. Maturin, never an early riser. Bonden, he called to his old friend, the captain's coxswain, pray desire your mates to pause for a moment. I wish to go downstairs, and I wouldn't tread on their work for the world.
Aye, Asher, said Bonden. Make a line for the doctor.
He led him by hand through the pots and brushes to the companion ladder, for the Nutmeg was lying to across the swell, and Dr. Maturin had never had much sense of balance except on a horse. And leaving him firmly attached to the handrail, he said, I believe we may have some fun after dinner, sir, with a conspiratorial smile. Stephen found Macmillan by the medicine chest trying to get paint off his trousers, and after some conversation about spirits of wine as a solvent and the extraordinary zeal of seamen in any faintly illegitimate and deceptive ploy, he said, And yet, as I'm sure you've noticed, the ordinary work of the ship carries on, as it were, by its own momentum. The glass is turned, the bell is struck, the watch is relieved, when a brace is required to be adjusted, or rounded in, as we say, the hands are there. The salt pork is already in its steep tubs, growing a little more nearly edible, and I've no doubt that at eight bells it will be eaten. Let us walk into the sick berth. Here they changed into Latin, and having looked at one hernia and two obstinate remaining Batavia poxes, he asked, How is our fourth man? Meaning Abs, a member of the afterguard, whose complaint was known as the marthambles at sea and griping of the guts by land, a disease whose cause Stephen didn't know and whose symptoms he could only render more nearly bearable by opiates. He couldn't cure it. He'll go in an hour or so, I believe, said Macmillan, opening the screen. Stephen looked at the comatose face, listened to the shallow breathing, felt the almost imperceptible pulse. You're right, he said. A release, if ever there was one. I should like to open him. I should like it of all things. So should I, said Macmillan eagerly. But it does so upset their friends, their messmates. This man had none. He was a galley ranger and had to mess by himself. Nobody came to see him but the captain and his divisional officer and mid. Then perhaps we have a chance, said Stephen, and pushing back the screen, God rest his soul. Dr. Maturin was mistaken about the salt pork. The breeze, against the promise of the sky and against the evidence of the barometer, so declined in the course of the forenoon watch that Captain Aubrey advanced his plan by an hour. And the pork was eaten, raw inside, at six bells. The hands didn't complain. By this time the Nutmeg had been made to look as shabby as the Altmar, and they were standing in with the prospect of an uncommonly brisk action within an hour or so. There was not so much a high degree of tension as of enhancement of all feelings. And when their grog came below, this didn't seem so much increased as infused with a great share of mirth. witty remarks exchanged between those who were to be allowed on deck looking like Dutch sailors during the approach and those who were not.
There are some slab-sided Dutch-built buggers that are allowed to show themselves, because why? Because they look so harmless, no one would be frightened of them. A maid wouldn't be frightened of them, nor a wife.
I rarely heard the people so cheerful, said Stephen in the captain's storeroom. They arranged Abs's body neatly between two chests, and he went on, I believe I shall go up and ask the captain whether we shall have leisure before the engagement. It's so tedious, struggling with the rigor mortis. But when he'd climbed the successive ladders, he saw to his surprise and regret that the Nutmeg was already well in with the land, and that although her pace was sober, moderate, mercantile, there would be no time for the autopsy he had in mind. Jack was eating a ham sandwich and talking to Richardson, but he looked across as Stephen appeared and smiled. Dr. Matron had slipped on the old black coat he usually operated in, and he could easily pass for a down-at-heel merchant supercargo. Jack himself was in loose trousers and shirt sleeves, and on his head he wore a Monmouth cap, a villainous, flat, worsted affair, still to be seen among old-fashioned seamen, which had the advantage of containing his long yellow hair, no longer so bright as it was in the days when he was familiarly known as Goldilocks, but still conspicuous. There she lies, he said, turning to Stephen. And there indeed she lay under the blue sky. A trim and elegant ship with her red gun ports open to air the deck. She was two-thirds of the way down the bay the Nutmeg was now entering. Framed by the shore with its white rim and by the rising forest land behind, bright green in places. There was quite a surf running, and white water could be seen beyond the Cornelly's starboard bow and here and there in other parts of the bay. The tide is at the full, said Jack. Slack water this last half hour. Have you been busy? There are sandwiches in the quarter gallery and a pot of coffee, if you feel so inclined. Dinner may be rather late. The galley fires have been out this age. We've been as active as ants, carrying our sick to their bay and making all ready in the berth. Lint galore, swabs, pledgets, chains, saws, gags. When do you suppose the action will begin? Not for an hour or so, unless she smokes us first. As you see, there's no plain ring of coral enclosing a lagoon. It's more a question of independent reefs, with a winding passage between them and a surprising great bar off the mouth of the stream. That's why she's lying so far out, no doubt. It's awkward for her boats, and when one of her cutters went in just now, I think she touched on the tail of the bank. Do you see the watering party? I believe so. At the foot of the black cliffs, 2 points on the starboard bow. Take my glass. The black cliff, the stream leaping down, and the seamen, gathered round their casks, came startlingly close in the brilliant light. There may be some extremely interesting plants on that damp rock face, said Stephen. May I look at the Cornelly? It might be indiscreet from the quarter-deck. The sash light in the quarter-gallery would be better. Do you see Dick on the foretopsail yard? He's going to con the ship from there. It ought to be the master, but his bowels are upset. We have to head almost for the watering place. Then there are two doglegs half a mile apart before we can luff up and run under a lee. I shall go and peer at them from the lavatory, eating a sandwich as I do so. Stephen, said Jack, in a low tone, look for Piero, Christy Pellier's boy, will you? I hope you don't see him, because that would confirm my idea he's ashore. I fairly dread killing him. You mean the young French officer you met in Poulaprebang, our friend's nephew? But you forget I never saw him, either as a boy or as a man. Very true, said Jack, forgive me. The Nutmeg stood on, with a captain alone on his quarter-deck, apart from a single man at the wheel and Hooper by the lee rail, looking like a ship's boy. Richardson stood high on the yard, looking down into the clear water ahead, dark blue for the deep water of the channel, light for the shoals on either side. A score of seamen stood about on the forecastle, their hands in their pockets, or lounged on the gangway, even leaning on the rail.
All the rest of the ship's company were out of sight under the forecastle, under the gangways, on the half-deck, and in the cabin. All the gun crews were at their stations, and those who could make out anything through the cracks of their port lids or through holes in the canvas strips told their friends what they saw in a low voice with striking accuracy. The boarders had their weapons at hand, cutlasses, pistols, boarding axes, pikes. Slow match smoked in tubs beside the carronades. Jack would never trust the flintlock alone. And now the atmosphere was grave. Behind its sliding door, the quarter gallery was quite cut off from the close-packed, attentive crowd and its rumble of voices. It was the captain's washing, shaving and powdering closet. And together with its companion on the other side, his privy, it was one of the few upper parts of the ship left undisturbed when she was cleared for action. With its washbasin removed, it made a pleasant little place from which to view proceedings. And Stephen was luckier with his sash light than any of the 100-odd below decks, except for those who could command a scuttle. Like them, he saw the Cornelie come closer as the Nutmeg glided diagonally across the bay, disappear from his field of vision as she took the first dogleg in the channel, and reappear 10 minutes later on the second, remarkably closer, still firmly moored. And as the Nutmeg continued her turn, the motionless Cornelie and the sea around her moved steadily forward, almost as far as his eyes could follow. It was now that he saw a signal break out at her masthead, just two imperative flags reinforced by a quarterdeck gun. The jet of smoke and then the crack, loud in this waiting silence. The strong voice from the deck above him, stand by there, man the lee braces. And the ship vanished beyond the edge of the sash light. For Jack, she was still very clearly in sight, and he didn't need his glass to see her open ports fill with 18-pounders run out. The Nutmeg was tracing the long curve that was to carry her alongside the frigate, now almost right ahead and broadside on. The French colours ran up to the Cornelie's mizzen peak. Jack waited for the warning shot. There was no warning shot. Instead, the three aftermost 18-pounders fired to kill almost simultaneously. All hands, called Jack, as the balls raced overhead at topsail height a few yards to starboard. It was clear that his disguise had been pierced, but although he might be raked fore and aft, he still hoped to sail the Nutmeg close enough to engage with real effect. Below him in the waist, the boatswain sprung his call. The officers came running up to the quarterdeck. Courses and staysails, said Jack. Bear a hand, bear a hand, bear a hand there. Mr. Crown, cast off the painted strips. Mr. Fielding, ensign and pennant. Stephen heard the crash of a ball somewhere forward, and then, in a turmoil more apparent than real, his door slid open and Seymour called in his ear, they've smoked us, sir. Captain desires you'll go below. The Cornelie's remaining 18-pounders fired in a long, rippling sequence, her side vanishing behind the smoke. Holes appeared in the topsails and courses. The tack of the mainsail, just belayed, sprang free. The balls sent water splashing from the forecastle aft. Several shot up white fountains close at hand. The last shattered the larboard cathead. Good practice for such a distance, observed Jack. Very creditable, sir, said Fielding. I wish it may not improve, however. A pause, during which the Nutmeg, in spite of a wild main course, advanced 200 yards, and then, in a deliberate fashion, all the Cornelie's larboard guns fired, one after another. 6 balls hit the hull, masts, or yards. One carried away half the larboard quarter gallery, and the 16th came the length of the ship at chest height, killing 2 men on the forecastle and 3 on the quarterdeck. Miller, just next to Jack Aubrey, a hand at the wheel, and the master. "Man the lee braces!" called Jack, wiping Miller's blood from his face. And to the man who had instantly taken over the wheel, "Port your helm!" The Nutmeg turned fast to starboard, and in a voice that reached the orlop, he gave the infinitely welcome order, "Fire as they bear!" Now the sick berth echoed not only with the sledgehammer blows of the enemy's shot, but the much louder cracking roar of the Nutmeg's 32-pounder carronades and the shriek of their slides as they recoiled. Stephen, Macmillan and Suleiman the loblolly boy were already busy. Splinter wounds, contusions, a forearm broken by a falling block. But as they stitched and bandaged and splinted, they nodded to one another with satisfaction. Bondon, carrying young Harper down in his arms, said, "We're slogging it out, sir. A pleasure to see." So they were. And the sky echoed and re-echoed with their thunder, a continuous roar beneath the separate explosions. The Nutmeg, like most Dutch 20-gun ships, carried all her armament on a single deck. She was firing into the wind so that her smoke was instantly swept away. It was therefore easy for the quarter-deck to see the pitch of her 32-pound balls. She was firing remarkably fast, at least twice the speed of the Cornélie. And her teams were working perfectly together, ammunition coming up from the magazines with clockwork regularity. But at high elevation their shot was wild, and at low, though their line was true, the balls fell short. The Cornélie was slow by any standard, partly because she was firing to leeward and the eddying smoke obscured her view, but even at 3/4 of a mile she was shockingly accurate. Furthermore, although she was clearly husbanding her powder, never wasting a shot, she quite certainly was not limited to 4 barrels, nor anything like it. "Stand by the chasers," called Jack. "Mr. Fielding, we'll wear ship." The Nutmeg turned, bringing the wind right aft, came up again on the starboard tack, and sailed off as she'd come. As she turned, the stern chasers managed to get in 3 shots each, 2 of which certainly went home. But the Cornélie fired 2 broadsides, the first of which might have dismasted the Nutmeg if she'd not put her helm hard over at the right moment. The second fell short. "If they'd fired as quick as they fired straight," reflected Jack, "we should have been hard up in a clinch and no knife to cut the seizing." He didn't confide this thought to his first lieutenant, however, but said, "She's finding it hard to win her anchor." Even without his telescope, he could make out that the short-handed Cornélie was having a wretched time at the capstan. And with it, he could see the straining, red-faced men, sometimes only 3 to a bar, trying to force the drum to turn. Then shifting over to the other cable, heaving on that, veering the first, and so trying again, rather than leave anchor and cables so many 1,000 miles from any replacement. "And they're having no better luck with their longboat," said Fielding. Jack turned, and there, on a small reef, not 1/4 of a mile from the shore, was the Cornélie's massive longboat, firmly wedged on a falling tide. From the white water on either side, it was clear that in his haste to join the ship, the coxswain had steered for a narrow passage through the coral, the nearest way, and had misjudged the breeze, or his draught, or the leeway, if not all 3. With real pleasure, Jack saw that the active officer in a skiff directing their urgent attempts at unloading the casks and refloating the boat was Pierre Dumesnil, that amiable young man, now in a frenzy of exasperation. "They have their work cut out for some little while, but not for too long, I hope," said Jack, looking up at the sun. "There's not a world of time to spare. Now, Mr. Walker?"
"A foot in the well, if you please, sir," said the carpenter. "But me and my mates have 3 comfortable plugs in the holds. There was only 3 hit us near or under the waterline. But the launch and the spars either side have suffered something cruel, and your larboard stern gallery's well nigh wrecked." Jack also heard the boatswain's report, which had few surprises. He could see cut rigging and damaged sails on every hand. And then he said to Fielding, "Let's heave to in the fairway with a stage over the side as though we were in danger of foundering. 6 hands can make the proper show while the rest are knotting and splicing, and we should pump but on the far side. Mr. Conway, pray ask the doctor whether it would be convenient for me to come below. Mr. Adams," he said to his clerk, "did you take notes?"
"Well, sir," said Adams, "I hardly knew what to do. Seeing we'd not beat to quarters, officially we weren't in action. So I made what I may call unofficial remarks. And seeing our people weren't killed in regular action, I told the sailmaker I thought they should be sewn up in their hammocks, not disposed of in the usual way. Well, I hope I did right, sir."
"Quite right, Mr. Adams." Down to the orlop.
and by the time he reached it, his eyes were sufficiently used to the gloom between decks for them to see Stephen's hands bright red under the hanging lamp.
"How much have we suffered?"
he asked. 3 splinter wounds died of loss of blood as soon as they were brought down or before," said Stephen. "Apart from that, I have 6 in a very good way with the blessing. A broken arm and some contusions, no more. For the dead you know better than I. The master, I grieve to say, young Miller, Gray, a good man at the wheel, and 2 more on the forecastle. A single raking shot. He sat between Harper and Semple, one of his bargemen, both of them splinter wounds, and told them how the day was doing. She could hit us very hard, and we could scarcely hit her at all. Our Agag hulled her 2 just abaft the cutwater," said Harper, light-headed with loss of blood. "I saw them go home with my own eyes. How we cheered! I'm sure you did. But now we mean to lead her on, lie in wait at the end of the passage, and engage her at close quarters. She's fouled her anchor, and her longboat is aground at present, but I dare say everything will be in order within an hour, and we can wait an hour.